640 Toronto presents Think Tank. The breaking stories you care about. Facts and opinions that get you through the day. Now, let's meet the guests.
Oh, we're excited to do that. It is a federal budget day. That's a big deal today. By the way, if you're wondering, is this simply a Canadian tradition where the finance minister buys a new pair of shoes? We should check that receipt from yesterday and make sure that wasn't some kind of a gift. I wish I could tell you that we stole this from the fogies in the UK, but we didn't. Canada made this tradition all their own. Nobody does this in America. Nobody does this in the United Kingdom. I'm letting people know that that's the case. Budget comes down at 4 o'clock today. Chloe Brown joins us right now. We love having her on Think Tank. Would you end the tradition if you were the finance minister of Canada, or would you be like, hey, new shoes? Who doesn't like that?
I'd put on my bed slippers for comfortable footing.
And go right back to bed and avoid social media after you laid down the budget and gave all the bad news to Canadians. Steve Paikin, yep. One of the finance ministers got Joe Oliver in 2015 selected a pair of New Balance running shoes. Those are the ultimate dad shoe, I feel like, in 2015. New Balance.
I think you might be right about that. But, you know, we've seen some alternatives in the past. I remember Jim Flaherty, when he was finance minister federally, decided not to buy new shoes. He just got a pair of old shoes resold, which I thought was very consistent with his brand. You know, there you go.
Yes. Just to let people know, yesterday, finance minister Chrystia Freeland picked out a new pair of shoes, and they had the shoe store come to her. Now, a place called McGuire Shoes, they're independent. They're owned by two sisters, Miriam and Rami McGuire, but they brought everything to... I'm worried this is a little bit like that scene where Julia Roberts goes back to the store in Pretty Woman, and Richard Gere's like, we need more... I don't know what else was tried on by Ms. Freeland yesterday. Maybe I'll leave everything there. There's no more analogies to be made with that,
particular one.
I think that's the best solution. Now, I will tell you both that multiple sources are telling Global News, because you can imagine when you spend money, you have to pay for things. And the concept from Mercedes Stevenson of Global News, Steve, is the federal budget will introduce measures that require the wealthiest Canadians to pay more. A wealth tax has never gone down well with G7 countries. I think we'd all agree that somebody making, say, 600 grand should pay a higher percentage than 60 grand. But this is going to be interesting. What's the threshold? Does this affect individual income? I'm fascinated to see where this goes today.
Well, we've got a long history in this country of believing in a progressive tax system, meaning if you make more, you pay a higher percentage of your income to the tax man or the tax woman in this case. And that is I think that's a relatively accepted way of doing business in the country, and has been for a very long time. Here's the thing, and I'm going to put something else on the in the window here, because I think if you look, and you referenced this a second ago, if you look at other countries that have really tried hard to soak the rich, it feels good on budget day, but it actually doesn't work, because the rich people can afford rich accountants who figure out ways to avoid paying this tax, and it never brings in as much revenue as you think it will. In fact, all it does is tick richer people off, and they end up taking their money elsewhere and leaving. So that's, as much as it might make people feel better today to soak the rich, I'm not sure it's actually going to accomplish what it set out to do, which is, in effect, bring more money into the Treasury. The way you do that, Greg, the way you do that is you, and I know people hate this, but this actually works. You send out auditors to make sure people who are supposed to be paying what they're supposed to be paying are actually paying what they're supposed to be paying. That actually brings in money. If we could get the people who are supposed to pay the taxes they're supposed to pay those taxes, you wouldn't have to increase taxes on people who are going to figure out ways not to pay that tax. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. And Chloe, we're there. I think the general public's right there with a lot of these fraudulent CERB applications. We noticed the CRA, the Canada Revenue Association, fired a bunch of people for inappropriate CERB claims, but are they going and bothering them and getting, trying to get the money back? No. And that's hundreds of millions of dollars. That seems like the baseline, as Steve's saying, to go get money that is actually owed to the government.
I definitely agree with Steve. When I look at even the provincial and territorial spending programs, the federal government doesn't really do a good job in setting firm outcomes that they want to see. The federal government more so acts like Daddy Warbucks and just signs checks without having really strong metrics for what it wants to see from the provinces, the territories, etc. And when it comes to just like wealth inequality, it's like I remember 10 years ago when it was 99 versus the 1% with the whole Occupy Wall Street thing. Things haven't changed because of what Steve said. The government doesn't send its auditors after the right people. Instead, it sends it after the little mom and pop shops, these small individuals, and we're losing a bunch of money through tax evasion. And there's no better example than our real estate industry.
Yeah, that's a really strong point right there. Just to let people know, if you make over $246,000 right now, your taxable income is hit at 33%. If you make between $55,000 and $111,000, it's at 20.5%. So that's, Chloe, that's a pretty distinct ratio. I think we'll have some controversy if we get closer to a 40% range for income. I don't know where this is going today. And as to Steve's point, yeah, like taxing the rich sounds great on paper, but we need businesses to employ people here as well and find that balance. There is a balance.
Definitely. And that goes back to Canada's productivity crisis, which is our employers underinvest in employees. There's a lot more money spent to import low-wage workers. There's a lot more money put into invest, like in bringing international students who basically are funding a lot of these companies based on their low wages and their slave labor. So yeah, there's a definite need to just look at how the government is subsidizing a lack of competition, a lack of productivity in order to keep everyone safe from competition.
By the way, Steve, fantastic Daddy Warbucks reference from Chloe there. I mean, generationally speaking, I didn't think anybody under 40 knew who Annie was, or let alone Daddy Warbucks. That's strong, Chloe.
I'm still waiting for her to drop Douglas in this conversation at some point.
Oh, it's coming. It's coming. And we don't quite know how Daddy Warbucks made his money, but I think the suspicion was like there was something like savings and loan. There's something going on there. There's some kind of a Bruce McNall. There's something that's not right, Steve, with Daddy Warbucks and all that cash.
Look at his last name, Greg. I thought he was an arms manufacturer.
Although the idea of a bald man in a black tuxedo presenting Canada's budget is really exciting to me. We're not going to get that today. You know, you can wish for things, but they don't generally appear. And just this, Steve, really quick to wrap up this one, is Martin Pelletier is going to join us, who's an investor after 8:30. He notes France put a wealth tax in 2015 and 12,000 millionaires left France in 2016. So this is exactly what you've said. The revenue generated from the wealth tax was lost with people moving. So we've got to find a way to make this work.
And it was really easy for them to do it. I know, like Gerard Depardieu, the actor, just moved to Belgium. I think a lot of people just, you know, Europe is a small place, you know, like we've got some ridings in Ontario that are bigger than all of Europe. And, you know, as a result, it didn't bring in nearly what they thought it would have or could have. And I hope we don't make the same mistake.
I feel like I read Keith Richards' biography and he kept mentioning how autobiography and he kept mentioning how the Rolling Stones had to keep moving and stay out of England for more than 6 months at a time or the taxman. That could have been access to substances in other countries, but I think it might have. I think it might have partially been about taxes. I don't know. All right, let's go to the Steve Paikin theory about the next provincial election. You laid this out on TVO. I'm fascinated by this. And you and I were chatting yesterday about the last time a quote unquote early election was called. It really dinged the incumbent. But you laid this out on TVO. Why would Doug Ford see the potential to go earlier to the polls than June of 2026?
Well, the theory is that we have a fixed election date law in the province of Ontario now. We have for almost 20 years, meaning that when it's a majority government, we have an election every 4 years. And we know the date right now of the next Ontario election. It's June 4th, 2026. But the thing is, that election, if the feds stick to their schedule, will come after the federal election, which is theoretically going to be October 2025. And we know it's worked this way for decade after decade after decade after decade. We know that Ontarians love to put different parties in power on Parliament Hill and at Queen's Park. And if Pierre Poilievre wins the next federal election, and if he gets the big majority that obviously the polls today suggest he would win, that means it changes the dynamic at Queen's Park. Don't ask me why. It just always does. So would Doug Ford want to jump ahead of that by having an early election, say after 3 years, and having the Ontario election before the federal one so that the dynamic does not change and that he can take advantage of the fact that he is the most popular party in Ontario right now? That's what I'm putting out there. I don't have any, I mean, nobody's going on record with me saying that it's happening other than The feedback I got yesterday was really terrific from people saying, I think this is exactly what's going to happen. And there are people who are thinking about this right now. Look at all the ads that are all over television all the time now, both pro-PC party and anti-Bonnie Crombie and the liberals. I mean, there's a ton of advertising money being spent right now, and we're still theoretically more than 2 years away from the next election.
Chloe, I'm really enjoying, it's your opportunity to do the, to Douglas now. There was a dance called the Dougies, but we'll call this the Douglas. I really enjoy the commercial because it's Doug Ford talking as he's getting dressed in the morning. And I'm like, who's he talking to? Like, it's very strange. There's a camera there. It's meant to be, you know, I get up every day. I like making these phone calls to the people, but it's really something. Do you see the benefit? Do you see why this could potentially happen, to get out of the way and get this done before the next federal election result?
Yes, I think Doug is definitely trying to save face because he knows that a lot of us are just waiting for the summer to start so we can openly boo him wherever we see him on a patio. I'm honestly of the thought that even if Doug is to not be successful at the provincial level, he'll try to go federal. So this is really Doug just trying to get in everyone's face, trying to pivot around the disastrous policies he's been putting forward, and potentially just secure himself a spot at the federal level, depending on what happens. Because Doug, if he is anything, is ambitious. So yeah, I'm kind of on the side of Steve where it's just like Doug is doing what Doug does best. He's being an opportunist and he's setting the groundwork for his future. So yeah, keep an eye on him.
Okay, but you're making me come. What's that, Steve?
There's one other thing on this,
yeah.
And that is, remember, there's an RCMP investigation into the Greenbelt and the government's activities on that scandal. And if that RCMP investigation, which apparently hasn't interviewed anybody yet, which suggests to me that it's probably 2 years away from reporting, wouldn't you want to, if you could, call an election before that report came out or before any charges were laid or before any of that, you know, hit the headlines? That might be another reason to go early.
And Chloe, I'll come back to you. I get where you're at with this, but there's just not been a lot of traction in the polls. The Liberals have a new leader. The NDP have had a leader now for 18 months. And there have been issues, for sure. Cabinet minister goes here. Cabinet minister goes there. We walk back the Greenbelt. I still see the Conservatives, Chloe, sitting at around that sort of 39% to 42% range. They're not getting dinged in the polls.
Yeah, but the polls are not always the best way to take the public's temperature, because right now, as you can see, one of our topics is going to be the Up Express. And that, for me, is a huge issue because I live right beside Bloor. So Doug is really just biding his time until the next crisis, because honestly, I don't get called by the pollsters. I have a cell phone number, it's not registered, and there's a lot of young people that are bubbling to the point of rage. So, yeah, the polls might not be showing our rage right now, but he'll see it on the streets this summer.
Here's what I think, and I think you're right on that, and Steve, I'll pivot it to you. Young people are really frustrated. We played a clip of an urban planner, Alex Beheshti, and he's 35 years old, and he said, it's so frustrating. I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm grinding it out. So is my partner. We do make more money than our parents did, and we're stuck here in Southern Ontario. So there's frustration with both the Trudeau Liberals and the Ford Conservatives similarly, and it just seems to come back to three words: housing, housing, and housing.
No, for sure. And one of the built-in problems, if we're looking at Queen's Park, that young people have right now, particularly if they tend to vote progressive, as some of them, I think the biggest chunk of them do.
Yeah.
Doug Ford's all there, all by himself on the center right. So anybody who likes his style of government has got one choice. If you want a more progressive option, you got the NDP, you got the Liberals, you got the Greens. For all of you progressive voters, your votes are being distributed over three different parties. And as a result, your chances of defeat, you know, and Ford he did a great job in the previous couple of elections, splitting the opposition votes well enough to allow him to win two consecutive majorities. So it seems to me, if you want to defeat Ford, people have got to figure out what the best option is and Put your chips on that one.
Well, I'm staying with this long here, Chloe. But the last point I'd make is, just even thinking about this, I sent Steve's theory and the column on TVO.org to a few people close enough to the Ontario Liberal Party, and they're unanimous. This wouldn't be good for us. Bonnie Crombie needs a seat, hasn't got one yet. The idea of an election being 14 months away instead of 24 months away, when you got 9 seats and you're trying to get 60, that's not very good for them.
Agreed. And this is where the Liberal Party really needs to dig deep and figure out how it's going to build an all-star team, because you have Nate, you have a few other, Dr. Sharma even, where it's just like they've been putting out great announcements, and this is the time for the Liberals to start reworking on their brand, because the truth is, Doug doesn't care if anyone votes. He's happy to win with like 10% of the population, because that is what Douglas does. So it makes it very advantageous for him to continue to put himself as the strong man while everyone else is scrambling to just get their brand right.
All right, the fence, Chloe. Tell us what you're reading.
That's right. That's right. And and Chloe Brown available for offers to be part of that all-star team. Let's push that. Let's push that out there. You're an all-star for us. So why wouldn't you be for them? Let's go to this Up Express issue then. I think this is fascinating. We just had somebody on who started a petition about it, and she lives near Weston Station. And she said a lot of people move to Weston Station because they know the frequency of the Up Express gets them downtown for work or play faster. But to let people know, the Up Express was meant to be, let's get you out to Pearson faster, light rail. And I think it's been a big success. Some bumps initially in those first couple of years, but I think it's a smoothly run machine. But this move yesterday from the province, Chloe, reduces the stops at Bloor and Weston. How would this affect your life? How would this affect your community's existence?
It grinds my gears because I'm a 15-minute walk from the Bloor station, and I've been able to use it to get to the airport to see friends on layovers, to pick up my family from the airport, and now it's really frustrating because I'm going to have to either go to Kipling Station, which is a 30-minute TTC ride, then take the bus over to Pearson. And it just shows how deeply Douglas is Douglasing, because no one asked him to do this. This Up Express was created for the Pan Am Games. And ultimately, it should have become a public rail system that was expanded, because I see the opportunity with Up Express like I see it with Go Transit. It needs to be integrated into the larger system. So it's one of those things where it's just like, I will see Doug in the streets this year because I need this service to be running. No one asked him to cut this vital service off from Torontonians who have to go between Pearson and downtown Toronto. So yeah, we'll see him out there.
But I'm going to ask what I asked the person who put the petition together. It's a half hour instead of every 15 minutes. Does that really move the needle to make people that furious to have 2 stops an hour instead of 4?
Yeah, because if you are late for work, even by 15 minutes 3 times, that's enough grounds to get you fired. So this becomes an issue of not only just getting you to the airport, but it's like people have been using it to just cut through the long TTC closures and a variety of other transit failures that have happened. And it's really unfortunate that the community of Weston, where they desperately need active transportation options, is getting screwed again. Because when I think of the Eglinton LRT, that's not done in their area as well. So, yeah, it's frustrating, because even if you're 15 minutes late, that goes towards your record. And I think a lot of airport workers are going to feel that pinch.
It is a fair point, Stephen, that when any of us go down to exhibition and we decide, okay, I'll do the right thing. You're telling me not to drive. I'll take the GO train and get off at exhibition. You get out from a game, a concert, whatever, the C&E, and some of those trains are an hour. Some you miss one, then you're standing there around for another 30 minutes. So I do get it. And we want more transit, not less. So this flies in the face of that concept, doesn't it?
That is all true, and oh boy, how do I ask for Chloe's forgiveness before I give this answer here? Well, I guess I just did. Look, I everybody understands that this is going to be less convenient, and everybody understands that in a perfect world, you would not want this service showing up less often. You'd want it showing up more often. Having pointed that out, Greg, you just actually made it. Oh, boy. Chloe, I'm sorry. I'm just going to apologize right now.
Just take me to the Blue Jays game.
They're not cutting the service. They're not cutting the service. They're cutting back the service, but the service is still going to exist. And we have to remember what the original purpose of the Up Express was. It was not to be a TTC-like commuter rail service. It was never intended to be that. It was intended to be a way to get to the airport quickly. And if you go by its original mission, there is nothing particularly inconsistent about what they're trying to do here. I understand people are going to be inconvenienced, and yes, that's a problem. But Can we afford everything? I don't know what we can afford. I haven't done the budgeting on this, but it seems to me the reason they're cutting back the service is because they need to save money. And this is the most subsidized light rail line anywhere in the province of Ontario. So there we go.
And I think before you go, Chloe, I think if the concept was, hey, we could charge you a higher fare, well, that would land like a lead balloon also. So if it's either higher fare and we run it four times an hour, or keep the fares where they are and it's down to two, I don't know how people would vote, but it'd be probably more in favor of keeping the prices where they are, Chloe.
Definitely, and this is why I say they should have expanded the line and integrated it into the larger transit plan, because ultimately, Pearson is just one destination. The rest of us love the line because it gives us options on how to transfer to GO, TTC, etc. And this is where the lack of vision from the province will always be the thing that breaks up the province, because ultimately this could have been integrated into the one fare plan that the province just put forward. This could have been a part of a larger strategy to connect it to the LRT system. There's so much opportunity with these four little stops that it's really unfortunate the government isn't thinking in the long term and how it could use that to eventually make Pearson better, because I don't know if you've been there lately, but Pearson is desperately needing a new workforce.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And you guys know probably there's the strike of food workers today. So you show up at the airport today, you may have close to 800 people on the picket line who aren't going to be putting meals and drinks on these Air Canada and WestJet flights today. So we'll see where that goes. Hey, I got to leave it there. Thank you both so much. Great debate today.
Good to talk to you guys.
There's Chloe Brown, Steve Paikin. You can hear them on Think Tank. They're on together on Tuesdays.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.